Boom. Welcome to an all new episode of Marty Talks, produced by Purse First Productions, Bob the Drag Queen, and Mitch Farino. I'm your host, Marty Cummings, and we're bringing you your favorite politicians, drag stars, and pop culture enthusiasts to talk all things everything. On today's episode, we have one of the people who inspires me the most, not only in drag, but also in political activism and revolution. All the way from San Francisco, the one and only, the icon. Make some noise from your living rooms or your cars or wherever you're listening from. But if you're driving and listening, don't round of applause, just scream and holler. The one and only Honey Mahogany. Hey girl, how are you?
Hey, how are you? It's good to actually get to chat with you again.
I am so excited. This has been a long time coming. We've been talking about doing this. I'm so happy we're connecting.
I know. It's been a long time. I mean, we've been chatting back and forth via email and Instagram, but I think the last time I actually saw you was at the Stud.
Oh my God. Do you know, I have not performed in San Francisco in probably like four years.
I think that's when it was. Yeah.
It's been a minute. Now the Stud, for those of you who don't know, the Stud is one of those bars where I feel like anything goes. Like, it is, to me, probably one of the most incredible venues I've ever performed in, because I had an experience. I don't know if you're aware of this. I had a fever one time I performed there, the time that Glamamore brought me in to do like a 90-minute show. I had a horrible fever, and my fever broke on stage, and my sweat hit the audience, and they like knew it, and they lit, like they lived. It was like one of those moments where I was like, I fucking love drag.
Yeah, it totally
was, it was wild. Like the audience like ate it up, because I went from like being kind of sluggish to, oh my God, my fever broke, I have this wave of energy, let's literally crowd surf.
Oh my goodness, that is incredibly I'm like, good thing that didn't happen during COVID.
Oh my God, right? It was during Folsom weekend, so there was, you know, some other stuff.
There was a lot happening. There was a lot going around, I'm sure.
Yes. Now you became one of the owners of the Stud, right?
Yeah, we formed a collective. I mean, you know, same old story. The bar was getting a lot of pressure due to gentrification and rising rents. And the owner actually ended up, you know, basically leaving after the building got bought by new owners. And they, you know, raised the rent on us. And about 17 of us got together and really just said, like, we can't lose another historic venue in San Francisco. I mean, at that point, you know, the Stud was the oldest continuously operating queer bar in the city. And it was a place where a lot of us grew up in the scene. A lot of us considered it our home bar as performers, as party promoters, as queers. We, you know, banded together and saved the Stud, at least at that time. And we actually formed the first collectively operated LGBT venue in the country at that time, and kept it going for 3 years. And then unfortunately, due to COVID, the Stud did close. But we are, you know, saving our coins and looking forward to opening it.
Yeah, well, I hope that it's able to survive this. You know, it's such a crazy time for so many of our small businesses, especially our queer spaces.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much pressure right now on small businesses in particular. Queer businesses obviously are extremely vulnerable. I think there was a statistic that also showed that, like, it was like Black and Latina women are probably losing the most jobs out of anyone in this current climate. And I think that any impacted community, you know, the most vulnerable ones are the ones that are always going to get hit the hardest by things like this. And we were having, you know, problems keeping gay bars open before COVID ever hit. And now, you know, it's just, it feels almost inevitable that we're going to lose some more.
Yeah.
And so I was really glad to see that Save Our Stages was included in the most recent COVID relief package from Congress. And, you know, I'm hopeful.
Yeah, you know, I always try to look at like what are the positive things happening in all of this, and I hope it makes people utilize small businesses more and like really get out there and realize the importance of small businesses, queer spaces, women-owned spaces, immigrant-owned spaces, Black and Latinx-owned spaces. You know, these like venues who, like you said, like the most like vulnerable populations among us who really need our support, and they're trying to, you know, have these businesses to provide for themselves and their community, their families. So I really hope that people have like learned how important it is to go to these spaces, go to your local hardware store instead of like ordering online, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and there are tons of ways in which people can support these businesses, right? I mean, like, I don't know. I think that we also have to look at different models of how we can sustain those, you know, community, those places that are really important to our communities. I mean, I think that we have a coffee shop here called Wicked Grounds, where they actually have like a membership, right? And that membership gets you certain privileges, but it's also a really easy way for someone to give like, you know, $10 a month to a place that they want to see continue operating. So I think especially moving forward, you know, I'm not saying the stud is going to like charge membership or anything like that, but like, you know, what this time I think is showing us is that there are more ways to be innovative and to I think help raise money and continue to basically preserve these like iconic and culturally important venues and safe spaces for our community, right? Because, you know, I think also now that I work at the city, I see like what a vested interest, a key part of our economy the nightlife is. You know, like in San Francisco, the nightlife generates like literally tens of millions of dollars in money for the city in terms of taxes. But also because, you know, when people go out, like when people go to the bar, or go to the club, they're not just going to the bar and club and spending money there, right? I mean, they're, you know, taking a cab or somehow, you know, transit there. And then they're also like going out to buy food and, you know, doing all these other things. Maybe they're going to a show and then to the restaurant and then to the bar, you know? And so it's a tremendous driver of our local economies. And I think that especially in San Francisco, we have a lot of emphasis on building housing, which is needed. Like we need more Hey.
Okay. We are back. The audio cut out. Sorry about that.
No, that's okay.
So I save that and then we'll just pick up from there. So I want to dive in and talk about, you had mentioned, you know, we were talking about the importance of nightlife, like the economic impact of nightlife. And in New York, we're facing that, you know, in a similar way to what you're talking about in San Francisco. You know, we have Broadway shut down, off-Broadway shut down, and that impacts not just the theater industry, but our nightclubs, bars, restaurants. And I served on the New York Nightlife Council. So, you know, seeing the impact of that is so huge. But now you're in government.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I work with a legislator, so in San Francisco, it's a city and county in one, and we have a board of supervisors, which is like the city council and, you know, the regular board, all put together. And one of the things that I'm working on right now is we have basically our local version of the Save Our Stages funds that we're trying to establish. So it'll create grants for venues so that they can, you know, pay back rents, pay mortgages, and then also pay employees or whatever other costs that they have, because a lot of these venues have such high overheads that any aid that they got from the federal government in terms of PPP loans that may have been forgiven oftentimes don't really aren't enough, and not enough to keep them alive. And some of them are even still waiting on those PPP loans. So if we expect a lot of these venues to survive into 2021, we definitely need to get them some help and get them some help quickly.
Quickly. Yeah. Now, how did you, okay. I look up to you so much because like, you started out doing drag, you're in politics, and you ran for office. You're doing the goddamn thing. Like it is, it's like, it's like, I'm like, you better fucking work, bitch. Yes. Like you are doing the thing. And it's so inspiring. Like, as a drag artist and a, you know, non-binary council candidate, like, I just look up to you so much. So, like, how did you take the leap from full-time performer into this, like, other arena?
Sure. I mean, I was a social worker even before, like, you know, really getting into drag. I mean, drag has always been a part of, I think, my adult life. I, you know, started doing drag in college and all that. But, you know, at the same time, once I graduated, I was really, you know, I got my MSW in social work. And it was actually, I studied a lot of the macro parts of it. So how, you know, laws impact the work that we do as social workers and how to work with cities and governments. And so I think I was already very much aware of how important it was to be civically engaged. And then I think when I was working as a programs director at the Rainbow Community Center in Contra Costa County, which is like in the suburbs of San Francisco. And I noticed that there were a lot of trans girls that were getting pushed out of the city, and they were being displaced into, like, basically, like, the sticks, with very little support, with no real modes of transportation, no health resources, no social resources, you know, very hard to find a job. There's a lot of discrimination, like, in that part of the Bay Area. It's not very safe. I mean, like, there's, like, white supremacy and white supremacists that are actively, you know, organizing in those parts of the Bay Area. And so I saw a lot of these girls really devolve. And I realized that this displacement that was happening of these girls that were moving out of, like, the Tenderloin and, you know, the South of Market or wherever else in San Francisco that they were living, where they had access to all of these things, these resources, that it was really life-threatening and dangerous for them to be displaced in that way. And so that's when I really got involved in the city in, like, anti-displacement work and you know, figuring out how we can mitigate gentrification, because I think, you know, cities change over time. That's a part of it. Like, you know, we have to continue to grow as a society, but that doesn't mean that we can't do it in a way that is protecting what makes our cities special and unique, and also protecting the most vulnerable. And that's why we founded the Trans District. And I think it was really through my work in organizing around both the Trans District, and again, sort of a similar storyline with the Stud, right? Like, preventing that displacement of a cultural institution due to the impacts of rising rents and gentrification, how we can protect those spaces and protect those communities and allow them to continue to flourish. It showed me how important the role of government is. And, you know, and then I realized that if we want help from our government, that it means that we need elected leaders who are going to listen to us and work with us. And that's how I got involved with the Milk Club here in San Francisco, which is a Democratic club, a progressive Democratic club, I should say. And
because there is a difference. There is a difference. I think people need to know, like, and that's something I want to talk to you about really quick. So sorry to cut you off, but okay. I just love that you, like, called that out, because I so often feel like a lot of people are slapping the word progressive on stuff now, but just because you say progressive doesn't mean there's a lot of, like, our party is very split, you know, where I feel there's, like, actual progressives, which I, like, you are like an actual progressive. And then there's people who are more kind of centrist. Mm-hmm. And so I'd love to hear, like, your kind of take on that, but we can circle back to that in a minute. I just wanted to flag that for a second.
No, yeah. I mean, I think that's important. I think that, like, for me, it was really, you know, I think San Francisco is also kind of a special animal, because we don't really have Republicans in San Francisco. I mean, we do, but, like, I don't think that there are any elected Republicans or even independents. Everybody's a Democrat. And we agree, I think, wholeheartedly on all the social stuff. It's really more about the fiscal stuff and sort of, like, whether, you know, are we prioritizing, like, affordable housing, or it's just, like, you know, YIMBYism and, like, build, and, you know, it's sort of trickle down housing economics. So, like, those are some of the key things I think that really in San Francisco define whether or not you're, like, a progressive or a moderate, is whether, you know, you are really sort of thinking about prioritizing the most vulnerable and marginalized communities and how we're building up for them, or whether you are also like prioritizing the needs of sort of like business and development, and what benefits that community, and believing that that is the way in which we are going to move forward and build opportunities for, you know, people who are, you know, disadvantaged, who are poor, who are, you know, middle or lower middle class, working class. I think it's interesting that we fight so hard. I think it's because we are really passionate about it. And I think because we are like, you know, sometimes it's when you have when you're like really similar that you sometimes bump head the most. But I do think that those are really key issues. Like, do we believe that like just building housing is going to all of a sudden lower rents? I mean, like the fact is that we know that in San Francisco, there's a huge amount of housing stock that just sits empty. You know, it's become a place where people dump money from overseas and invest in property and leave
it. Oh my gosh, yeah.
Right? And they just leave.
That's in New York too. We have these thousands of apartment buildings that cost millions and millions of dollars. These huge high-rise monstrosities that are empty.
Mm-hmm.
Completely empty. Yet we have 90,000 people experiencing homelessness,
mm-hmm.
you know? And it's like, this is like mind boggling to me that we can live in, you know, in the New York perspective, like the wealthiest city in the country, where Jeff Bezos can buy a $90 million apartment that he doesn't even live in.
Right.
And this is happening.
Right.
Like it's, yeah, we have to prioritize the needs of the people, you know, and we've been dealing with it, and I'm sure you've experienced this in San Francisco with COVID. The city's been putting a lot of the people experiencing homelessness into hotels that have been vacant,
mm-hmm.
and now we have this NIMBYism that's happening where people are, you know, it's like, oh, we're progressive, quote unquote, until there's a hotel of displaced people living there, who then they're labeled as, oh, I don't want those people
right
here. And it's like, I see you. I see who you are. You know, it's really such an interesting thing. I feel like we've really been seeing a lot of like people's true colors
mm-hmm.
of late, you know, I mean, really the last 4 years, but specifically, you know, really recently. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about, you know, at the time of this recording, we're just a couple of days, you know, this is what's today, the 10th of January,
mm-hmm.
you know, we're days away from a new administration, but articles of impeachment are about to be presented to the House again. We just had a terrorist attack from white supremacists on the Capitol. What is your kind of like, I mean, it's just so mind boggling to watch it all unfold, but what is your kind of take of what's like happening right now?
I mean, you know, I'm not surprised. And to be honest, there were, you know, I've had friends that we've been discussing this with who are like, yeah, there's going to be, you know, this is going to lead to civil war because of the way that people were like, there are certain parts in the country where people are putting up like Trump 2024 signs before the election happened. Right. And they, you know, really buy into this false narrative of QAnon and of, and more recently of like the election being stolen, and, you know, Trump is stoking these sentiments. And then there are, you know, everyone who's complicit with that, right? Like the Rupert Murdoch's of the world, you know, Steve Bannon's and all of those people. I don't even know all the the networks that, you know, people tap into on the right. I just know that they exist. And I know that people really believe them as truth and take what they say as fact. And then they have these Republican politicians who, from the beginning of Trump's presidency, before Trump got into office, before he was the Republican nominee, you know, basically said that they knew that he was a liar and a fake, and that, you know, disavowed him and said what a horrible person he was, and then turned around and completely legitimize everything that comes out of his mouth, uphold him as the Republican standard, and, you know, basically do whatever he says in order to, for them, for him to maintain power and also to maintain their own power. And I think that the result of all of that is what we're seeing now, you know, and
is what we're seeing. Yeah.
And there's a, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, there's a lot of those people who, you know, were against him, and then for like Lindsey Graham, Mitch McConnell, then they were for him because they wanted to get that Supreme Court and those judicial judges in. They got what they wanted. Now that there's like a coup, they're jumping ship. But then you have these newly elected Congress members who are QAnon, like Marjorie, what's her name, from Georgia. There's one, a woman from Staten Island who's one of them. And then Holly, who's a newly elected senator. Like, you have these people who are like, they're newly elected, and they really, like, they're not jumping ship because they support what is happening, which is terrifying, that there are electeds in this country who, I mean, it's just, I always say, it's like, our country was founded on the basis of systemic racism. And so this isn't new. We just now have cameras and social media platform to really spread it to a way where it devolves into what's happening.
Yeah. And I think that that's probably the key thing, is that, you know, when the founders of this country, you know, when we established the free press, we didn't, I don't think, take into consideration social media and what impact that would have. Because the problem with social media is that it has allowed disinformation to be sown and distributed and taken as gospel in a way that I don't think anyone really foresaw. And it, you know, the fact that Twitter and all of these other social media companies are now banning Trump, like, too little too late, like, even more
too little too late. You knew. Mm-hmm. And they made money off of it. Mm-hmm. And now they're pulling out.
Right. After the damage has already been done. You know, there was, I mean, it's there. I'm not saying that what they're doing isn't significant and consequential. I think that, you know, potentially what they've done at this point is really help save lives, because there could be some really mass organizing happening right now that is really dangerous. But at the same time, like, we could have, if this had happened earlier, right, we could have, I think, the country would be far less damaged than it is right now.
Than it is now, yeah. I mean, we're damaged not just internally, but, like, on the world stage. Mm-hmm. I was talking to a friend of mine, Marisha Wallace, for the podcast earlier, who lives in London, and just like, just the impact of how the rest of the world is looking at us. You know, we're supposed to be like, you know, the glittering, gleaming hope of democracy, and we have this happening. It's like insane. But I want to switch gears a little bit and ask, you know, because you are in politics, you're like such a badass. Do you see yourself running for like a higher office?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I am interested in running for office in San Francisco. I think that, you know, it is about time we had a trans person in office in San Francisco. But more than that, like,
has there ever been?
No, there has not. You know, I think that there have been gay men. I don't even know if there has been a lesbian that's ever been on the board of supervisors. Certainly not. We haven't had a gay or lesbian or trans mayor either. So there's definitely room for improvement there. But I want to run because I feel like, you know, I started off as a grassroots organizer, as a social worker, as someone who was really in it for like, helping my community and righting injustice. And I feel like too often we see people who, you know, rise in government who come from a political training school, like who are in politics to be in politics and amass power. And I don't think that that changes unless, you know, we get folks like us, like, you know, you and I and others who have lived life as parts of these disenfranchised communities and want to bring that knowledge and that lived experience to our government, right? To city hall, to state government, to, you know, the federal government as representatives. And I think it's only when we're able to do that, that we actually can see significant change happen. So that's why I want to run.
Absolutely. I always say there are two types of politicians, right? There's the type that's like, they run for office because it's a resume thing to jump to the next thing. And, you know, it's about the title, the power. Then there's the type of people who run for office, like you, who are, and I believe myself as well, who, you know, they want to be of service to the people around them. Mm-hmm. Make real change that's going to impact the most amount of lives for good, you know? And I think that's where we have to like really shift our politics. We need to be showing up to be of service to others. Like, we, you know, if you're in government, it should be to make people's lives better.
Right.
You know, like, that's what it's about. And so I get so frustrated when I see people running who I'm like, your intentionality is like fucked. Like, you should be doing this because it's like you would be given the opportunity to pass legislation that can provide the housing that we're talking about, the small business relief we're talking about, you mm-hmm. know, to help, you know, with equitability mm-hmm. and equality, not just so you can like have a fucking job title. It's just so mind blowing, like, some people's intentionality. But you guys have like such an incredible, I'm like envious of San Francisco sometimes, because so many of your drag artists in your community are so politically engaged.
Mm. Yeah.
Which is like,
I mean, I think, incredible. I think in San Francisco, there's like a long history of that here. You know, Jose Saria was a drag queen who
1969, right, yeah.
ran for office and, you know, didn't win, but then established the Imperial Court here in San Francisco, and that grew, and it continues to through to today, where they are, you know, continuing to raise money for the community. And then there was the Ducal Court that was also established to do that. And there's been, I mean, I think in every part of the country, drag queens and drag shows have been used to raise funds for the queer community. I think back in the day, for those of us who've been doing drag longer than RuPaul's Drag Race has been around, like, we all
hello
we yeah. all remember that drag queens were not respected, that, you know, for a long period of time,
for the longest, like, it was a hustle. And like, even like people, you know, within our own, like, now it's very mainstream, but people in our own community like weren't going to the shows all the time.
Exactly.
Either.
And
it was looked down upon. When I first started drag, I remember it was hard for me. Like, I'm very grateful. I'm in a very loving, you know, I'm married, very grateful, whatever. But when I started drag, you know, and my boyfriend at the time and I had broken up, and I was like out there doing my drag thing and trying to date. Nobody wanted to date me or like tell people they had slept with me, because they were like, no femmes, no. It was very looked down upon. But then it became like such a thing that everybody was like, now it's like, everybody wants to date a drag queen and be a drag queen. Mm-hmm. And whatever. It's like so crazy, the shift. But I'm like, a lot of these younger queens, I'm like, oh, you know, you don't. And I haven't been doing drag that long. I mean, but like professionally, like, 10 years as my full-time job, but like really for like 13 or 14 years, so not even that long, you know. I look at like the folks like Sherry Vine and Peppermint and Shaquita in New York, who like have been doing this, Varla, Coco, like, who have been doing this hustle, Mona Foote, who we sadly lost to COVID this year, like these legends who like hit the fucking pavement so like the queens of today can like have that
totally work. And, you know, and like, I just remember that, like you said, queens were not respected. And like, not only that, like, even the only times that we were brought forward was when the community needed to do a fundraiser and they needed to do a drag show. And that
girl, it was, ain't that the motherfucking,
it was drag piece. Queens and porn stars. It's like, when we need to raise money, yes, come and like, do a show,
like the dog and clothes, pony show,
raise us some money. And then, when you're done, go back into the dark corner over there. Keep the cameras away from them. We're normal. We're just like straight people. You know, we just want to get married and have kids. They don't exist.
Oh, like, my God. Is that not the tea? Bitch, I say that all the time. Who are the people who raised money for all your shit all those years?
Yeah. Drag queens and porn stars. And
drag queens and porn stars and sex workers. Yes. Mm-hmm. That is it. Mm-hmm. Like, and so now, like, I mean, I'm grateful that it's more in the mainstream, but I wish, and I'm gonna maybe this is a little controversial, but I remember in the early seasons of Drag Race when they would play like they would do like a clips of like the queens who made this possible,
and
show like legendary queens. And now it's like, I always say to young queens when I host competitions, I'm like, who are the drag artists that inspire you? Don't name a Drag Race girl. I want to know who are the queen. And that's nothing to get, like, I have so many, like, Bob is the producer of the show. You know, I have so many friends who I've worked with who have been on Drag Race. I watch the show. I kiki. I love it. We sit down every Friday night and watch it. But I tell these young girls, like, there is drag out there that has been out there mm-hmm. for a long time. Who are those artists that inspire you too? And I wish the show would still show those artists, which they used to in early seasons. They don't anymore.
I have a very different relationship with Drag Race than I think maybe a lot of, I wouldn't say a lot of other girls, because I feel like it kind of goes, there's a spectrum. But I think that for myself, like, you know, as much as I love my Drag Race sisters, like, they're not the ones that inspired me, you know, growing up in drag. And maybe I sound old now saying that, but like, it was really the girls that I grew up around in the bars who inspired me to perform, who like I got to watch, you know, mesmerized as they did their thing on these little stages in the corner of bars on top of pool tables.
On apple boxes.
That is what inspired me. You know, Drag Race is, I'm super grateful for Drag Race. I think it's done really powerful things for the community in general. But, you know, I think, you know, it's a little bit, there's realness there, but it's also Teflon, right? I mean, it's TV. And yes, we can meet these people. Yes, we know who they are, but people who actually live and work in our communities, who, you know, are with us, you know, whether the TV is on or not, like, those are the people that inspire me. Not necessarily the people who make good TV, but the people who are good in real life.
The people who are good in real life. Yeah, absolutely. And I also see, like, you know, I've had friends who have been on, and I don't want to like focus on Drag Race, but like, I have friends who go on it, and it's like, who are like incredible people who do incredible work for the community with their drag. And then they're on the show, and for whatever reason, like, the fans don't click with them, or something doesn't happen, and their career is like,
Well, that, you know, Drag Race isn't about that. I mean, it's a reality TV show. And this is something that I don't think that I was wise to when I was on the show, that it is all about reality television, and it's not necessarily about how good of a drag queen you are, or, you know, like, it's about being entertaining and making it, having an entertainment and an entertaining storyline. And so, you know, unfortunately, there are some people whose personalities, you know, shine a little bit brighter, who are willing to be a little bit more dramatic on the show and make a bigger splash, and that's what it's about, and that's okay. Like, that's valid, and that is a form of entertainment. Like, I'm watching La Veneno on HBO, which I think is,
oh my god, it's so good.
so good. And just like her personality and her you know, her, the way that in which she takes the stage and holds everybody captive is just so incredible and heartbreaking and beautiful. And you know, and it's a little bit like Drag Race. Like, I feel like what she's going through on this show is a little bit like being on Drag Race. It's like, you know, you kind of have to learn how to play the game. And there's parts of it that are really beautiful and amazing and fantastic. And there's parts of it that are kind of dark and sad. And so, you know, that's show business. You know what I mean?
That's,
and politics. I
mean, that is show business. There is the good and the glamour and the sparkle and the shine, and then there is the dark. That is show
and
business.
And that is also like, oh my, also politics goodness. Is, I feel like, very similar.
And politics. I'll tell you, I always tell people when they're like, oh, you're a drag queen, how are you? And I was like, listen, if I can be in a dressing room with 15 drag queens at 1 a.m. hooting and hollering and dealing with all of their drama, I can deal with these politicians, okay?
Right.
We're right. Good to go. But I'll tell you, like you learn real quick in drag and in politics who your real friends are and where their values are. And that's, I try to gravitate towards, like, the goodness, you know? We need joy. We need joy. Like, it has been a dark... Speaking of, you know, things being dark, it's been a dark 4 or 5 years, and we need joy. Like, I try to find joy in my drag now more and try to look at it as like, yes, it's my profession and it's my job, but I want to radiate joy when I'm in front of my audience, because I want them to take that with them. In my politics, I want to radiate joy because I want people to feel hope,
yeah,
and joyfulness, and like that there it are people who mm-hmm. give a shit, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, it's really powerful. I just think we need really that. Powerful.
Mm. What a crazy absolutely time, girl.
Well, I'm super stoked that you're running for office, and you've been like, you were on the game early. You did that so right, because you know people are gonna like know who you are and know your name, and I think that so many people like jump in, you know, kind of late in the game. And
yeah, we started really early. We launched in September 2019. My election's in June. There's a lot of people in the race. I'm friends with them. They're good people. We have ranked choice voting here, which I think you have in San Francisco also. So it's super helpful. But I also know, like, I'm not the establishment pick, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm super leftist, like, progressive, you know? Like, I'm not, like, the establishment's pick. And you know, also, like, reaching voters and explaining them when they're like, oh, you're a drag queen. But, you know, then being like, yeah, this is how I've been prepared for this, you know? But we've reached, like, I'm super proud of our team. Like, we've been, like, hauling ass, and I'm, like, I look at it as, like, and I'm sure you feel the same way. Like, I look at it as, like, my goal is to win. I think I'm the best suited for the job, and I'm ready to get in office and work for the people in my district in the city. But I also know, like, if I happen to not win this primary in June, you know, I'm proud to be the first drag queen in the city to do this. I'm proud to be the first non-binary person to do this. And I hope that it lets some, like, little kid, or maybe not even a little kid, like an adult, whoever. I hope it makes them feel like they can do this too.
Absolutely. I mean, you've definitely inspired me as well. So I think it's I know you said earlier that I inspired you, but I think it's a two-way street. I think, you know, I am super impressed by all the work that you've done in putting forward your campaign. And I definitely, you know, it's historic. And regardless of what happens, no one can take that away from you. But, you know, and you very well could win. So I will keep my fingers and toes crossed for you.
Well, thank you, thank you, thank you. You are just a light. You are a light in the world. Oh, I wanted to say, what is your, so because it is the new year, before we close out, and we're like still, you know, 10 days into the new year, so we can still do, you know, what are our resolutions, but I don't really like saying resolutions. So what are your intentions for 2021?
Oh my God, there's so many things that I want to do for 2021. It's like I have all of these legislative things, but you know, on a personal level, I think I just want to get everything in order. Like, I'm getting ready to move out of this place that I'm living in currently, and moving into a new space, which is a little bit closer to work for me. And I'm just really looking forward to like getting, like, it's a very central location. It's right by a gym and right by a grocery store. And so just like, you know, improving, doing all those things that everyone promises themselves that they're going to do. So hopefully once COVID is over, I'll be able to go to the gym, which is right there, and, you know, just have a little bit more of a balanced lifestyle. That's what I hope for in 2021. I mean, we all are hoping, I think, that we'll see things improve across the country with the new Biden administration. I have to say, like, I'm really impressed by his appointment so far, and hopeful for mm-hmm. what
yes.
President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris can do for our country.
Well, I'm excited for some balance as well. it will be nice, and I'm happy that our yeah, just God, this new administration can't mm-hmm. come soon enough.
I hear you, girl.
But we'll get through it. We'll get through it together. We'll, you know, we can do this. But I am so grateful to you and your leadership. So thank you for taking time. I know you're busy. So thanks for taking time to join us on
the show today. Oh my gosh, thanks for having me.
And to all of our listeners, share the episode. Tell your friends to get into this episode. and stay tuned for new ones. Thank you so much, honey. And everyone, make sure you are also liking Purse First Productions. Thank you to our producers, Bob the Dry Queen and Mitch Farino. And until next time, spread love and don't be a dick.
Thank you, love. Bye.